It's the spring of 1994, and two lawyers in Arizona are about to do something that will change the young internet forever. Lawrence Cantor and Martha Siegel are writing a simple message advertising one of their services. They'll take care of all the tedious legal work you need to do to enter the lottery for a green card, for a fee. They leave out one small fact. Anyone can do this for free just by mailing a postcard to the State Department. Once they're finished, Lawrence and Martha post the message on a forum on Usenet. Then they post it on some more, and more, and more. When the dust of their posting spree settles, their ad is on more than 5,000 other forums. This is widely believed to be the first mass spamming of the internet. It's known as the Green Card Incident. Lawrence and Martha's spam overwhelms the platform. Its users feel trapped by the relentless and misleading ads. Usenet and other platforms respond by launching a war on spam. Of course, for people like Lawrence and Martha, finding new ways to advertise is just part of doing business. And to be clear, at the time, Lawrence and Martha did not break any laws with their spam and their relentless and misleading ads. But thanks in part to their work, an arms race ensues that pushes the internet to the brink of collapse before many of us even knew it existed. The relentless flood of spam online in the mid-90s led to demands for internet regulations. Those demands led, in part, to the law that included Section 230. And now that Section 230 is under attack and repeal is on the table, we're closer than ever to returning to that world of nonstop spam clogging our feeds. I'm Mike Masnick. This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet. In this episode, we're traveling back to the explosion of the World Wide Web in the 1990s.
At that point in time, there were no rules of the road for the internet.
We're exploring the biggest debates of the dot-com era.
This is really creating perverse incentives to leave a bunch of garbage up on the internet.
And stepping into the shoes of the lawmakers who laid the groundwork for the internet as we know it today.
We understood also that there needed to be a way to deal with these problems that didn't ruin the entire internet.
I wanted to be in this for the small user, and I still am.
Tonight, the information superhighway and one of its main thoroughfares, an online network called Internet.
There are the online services, computer bulletin boards, where you can converse with people you've never met or seen.
When we left off, the early Internet was blowing up. Early users were being flooded with spam and unwanted content, and moderators were struggling to keep up.
Usenet was a chaotic mess.
The quality of discourse deteriorated, but worse than that was just the spam.
The internet saw its first major legal case with Cubby v. CompuServe. Remember that the judge had to go all the way back to the 1950s to figure out how to deal with this brand new technology.
A federal judge in Manhattan said CompuServe is the digital equivalent of a newsstand, and the case is dismissed.
And that decision had some unintended consequences.
So that's part of what triggered this disincentive for platforms or message boards at the time to say, we're not going to take anything down. We're not even going to look at it.
With no clear rules for the internet and billions of dollars being invested in this new industry, the stakes couldn't be higher. But one lawmaker was on the case, Chris Cox.
Looking at this case and imagining what would be the consequence, I had plenty of time to think about it on that airplane ride. And so I sketched out on a yellow legal pad, you know, the beginnings of what became Section 230.
Chris had plenty of experience in the House. He knew that to get his idea passed into law, he needed to collaborate. Going alone wasn't an option.
If you're making significant change in American life, it's very hard to do it on a purely partisan basis. So it was also, you know, we needed the best thinkers to think about this because this really was a new problem. This really was new to the law, and it really did require fresh thought. And Ron Wyden, for example, was very, very thoughtful about these tech issues.
My state has always been about wood products and agriculture. We will always care about it. But I wanted to get into some new stuff. I'm Ron Wyden, and I'm one of Oregon's United States Senators, and what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now is hard to explain.
You've probably heard Senator Wyden's voice in the news lately. He's been very busy as the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. But the senator has always had an interest in technology.
People ask me now about technology and treat it as a separate subject. I said, what are you talking about? It's everything. It's healthcare, it's agriculture, it's recreation, it's whatever it is. And it was really a source of great frustration for Chris Cox and I that the Congress was being so slow to pick up on technology and new ideas.
Back when Chris Cox was working on the idea that would become Section 230, Ron Wyden was still in the House of Representatives. And as a Democrat who was excited by and informed about tech, he was the ideal partner for this plan.
Well, that partnership, you know, dated back to an earlier lunchtime conversation that we had in a very segregated facility in the House of Representatives in the Capitol, that is to say the members' dining room, segregated in the sense that Republicans sit here and Democrats sit there and they don't eat with each other in the main.
There was a little room off the House floor. And members could come, and nearly everybody who went there talked about sports, and particularly because I went to school on a basketball scholarship, dreaming of the NBA. I was something of a sports magnet because people thought I was better than I actually was. I was a college scrub, but there were House members who thought I had played in the NBA, and so I was a little bit of a hub of activity there in the congressperson's lunchroom. But Chris Cox and I found each other one day and we started, you know, talking about this whole new concept of communications.
He and I were having lunch at Table for Two and bemoaning this fact that there wasn't enough cross-pollination in ideas for that reason in the House. And we, you know, kind of wondered why that was so. And my explanation for why it was so is that in political life, people are trotting well-worn paths when the same questions are asked over and over again.
I think it's important for people to have the chutzpah and the grit to try new things.
Maybe the way to get Democrats and Republicans on the same page would be to ask new questions about, you know, sort of greenfield issues that haven't been approached yet in public policy, cutting-edge issues where everybody has to start from scratch and think anew, think fresh thoughts about how to solve these novel issues, novel problems. And so here we now have my plane ride notes. And I brought him back to him and said, well, what do you think of this one? And he immediately saw the need and the potential for bipartisan legislation, and away we went.
Chris and I had no idea where this was going to go, but we thought that it was going to make a difference and it was going to be good for freedom and good for innovation and good for this new thing that everybody was just getting their arms around. And we're talking about dial-up and all this kind of stuff. We didn't know where it was going to go.
But before they could start crafting their bill, a bombshell dropped.
It's kind of funny and interesting how shady characters like a Wolf of Wall Street are behind something so monumental as the rules of the road for the internet.
It was a blockbuster lawsuit that would put Chris Cox and Ron Wyden's feet to the fire. Could they get a law in place before the internet buckled under the weight of a million lawsuits?
So around 1993, I was an unknown lawyer trying to find my place in the legal world, and I ran into a couple of unsavory characters.
That's Jake Szymanski. If you've heard of him, it's likely for trying to clean up Wall Street in the early 2000s. But in the mid-90s, he was crossing paths with one of finance's most notorious criminals.
A guy named Jordan Belfort, who ran a boiler room. I met him at a party in the Hamptons. And Jordan Belfort turned out to be the character played by Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street.
In case you missed it, the movie follows the rise and fall of a playboy stockbroker and wild party boy.
You know what? I'm not leaving. I'm not fucking leaving!
But Jake met Jordan Belfort, about a decade before the FBI would take him and his company down for securities fraud. And Jake found Jordan intriguing.
Very gregarious guy. The ultimate salesman. He originally sold steaks to restaurants. And he said, if I can sell steaks, I can sell stocks. So he started a brokerage firm, and he was looking for, you know, legal help because a lot of people were suing him.
Jordan ran a firm called Stratton Oakmont. It was a boiler room, a high-pressure stock brokerage where salespeople cold-called potential clients all over the country and tried to convince them to invest.
As a young lawyer looking for, you know, exciting cases, we seemed to have a great fit. So that was my first big client. Jordan Belfort and Stratton Oakmont was the name of the company.
Jake had no way of knowing that he was taking on a case that would become the catalyst for Section 230.
I was representing Stratton Oakmont for a couple years, and they invited me to their Halloween party out at their mansion in Long Island. So I show up. I was dressed as Top Gun in a flight uniform and sunglasses, and I was called or summoned upstairs to meet with Belfort and Danny Porish. Danny Porish was the second in command, and he was played in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street by Jonah Hill. And he said, Jake, I've got a tough case for you. I said, anytime. They said they didn't know who it was, but somebody got on this online service Prodigy and posted false and defamatory statements about the firm, Stratton Oakmont. They said the firm was involved in fraudulent public offerings and that they were a bunch of criminals and fraudsters. So I said, well, that's interesting, but what do you want me to do? And they said, go sue them and get them to take it down. So I started doing research. I didn't know anything about libel or defamation, and I didn't really know much about the internet either. At that point in time, there were no rules of the road for the internet.
If this were a movie, we'd see Chris Cox and Ron Wyden sitting in the congressional lunchroom while Jake and Jordan and Danny Porish are at that party. There's no Section 230 yet, but you can feel it coming. Meanwhile, Jake does his research. First, he has to learn what Prodigy is. Today, you and I can probably name a dozen or so internet service providers. Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, Optimum, Spectrum, Starlink. But back then, there were only a few internet service providers. One was CompuServe, who you heard about already. Another was America Online. And then there was Prodigy. Cyber law expert Jeff Kossoff explains.
They were really looking at parents who were increasingly connecting their home computers to the internet so that their kids could do research on online encyclopedias, things that might seem quaint now, but it was a pretty revolutionary thing.
So that's where the post came from. Then there's the content of the post itself. Jake learns that someone accused Stratton Oakmont of fraud related to a recent public offering that they'd been a part of.
You know, later on, certain charges were made against Stratton, but not at the time that these messages were posted. If you call somebody a criminal and they don't have a criminal record, that's false and defamatory.
To build his argument, Jake had to tap some experts. First up, the author of some of the earliest articles about online libel.
And I asked him to explain to me the libel law and defamation, basically, if someone publishes false and defamatory statements about you, you can sue them for libel. The key word is publish.
Jake took note of that legal standard and moved on to the next mission of his investigation. Find out who was behind the original post.
Prodigy had what they called an online bulletin board or a chat room where investors and other people could go on and talk about stocks. You log in, you post information, and you generally have either an email address or some handle where you could identify who the person was.
With the help of an IT consultant, Jake was able to retrieve the email address linked to the original poster.
I found through my investigation that this guy was an ex-Prodigy Services employee who was living in Key West, Florida. He said he had never heard of Stratton Oakmont and that he did not post the material. I found that astounding, but he seemed very believable. So I asked him, I said, well, what must have happened here? And he said, somebody actually hacked into his account or used his account to log on to the Money Talk bulletin board of Prodigy and posted these false and defamatory messages. I said, well, now that I'm here, explain to me how Prodigy operates and the Money Talk bulletin board. He said, well, with Money Talk, they have an editor who, you know, screens for content. Well, having learned a little bit about libel law, my ears perked up and I said, wow, an editor? So I said, well, you know something? That to me sounds like the publisher, like the New York Times, and I'm going to run with it.
Remember that in the Cubby case from the last episode, CompuServe only got off the hook because they didn't edit or moderate. The court decided that they were like a newsstand, not a newspaper. But Prodigy did edit. Jake had found his smoking gun.
So with the knowledge I had acquired, I pieced together a lawsuit and filed a lawsuit in state court in Nassau County, Long Island, a little town called Mineola. And I filed this online libel suing Prodigy. Prodigy must have been laughing at me. You know, who is this guy? Well, within a matter of days, I get contacted by one of the major, you know, white shoe law firms who represent all the publishers and newspapers saying that they were now on the case and I'd be fighting with them. What do I know? And how am I going to prove my case?
When Stratton Oakmont finally had their big day in court, Jake had a feeling he was in for a wild ride.
I could tell it was an important case. It was me by myself, and there was a whole team of lawyers on behalf of Prodigy. You know, five suits with briefcases walk into the room, and their lawyers were saying, you know, this is preposterous. You can't sue us. We're just a conduit of messages, information. They compared themselves to a telephone. If you call somebody on the telephone, you can't sue AT&T, you know, for defamation. I said, Judge, the big difference between a telephone and this is Prodigy does editing. They screen for content. They take down defamatory messages. And the judge was struck by that. I could see that, you know, I had piqued his interest.
Prodigy's lawyers were quick to cite the only case law that existed on libel in the internet, Cubby v. CompuServe. Here's cyber law expert Jeff Kossoff.
What Prodigy says is this is exactly like the CompuServe case. We're a digital newsstand and we had no reason to know of this one post, so you should let us go. You should dismiss the case. And the judge says, not so fast. You're actually very different than CompuServe. CompuServe, the company, did not get involved in what would be known today as content moderation. Prodigy had a very different philosophy. So Prodigy wanted to market itself as the family-friendly alternative to CompuServe. So they were just fundamentally two very different business models.
Because of the conflicting logic of the only previous case law, the judge had to weigh his decision carefully. He explained to the Prodigy lawyers,
because you moderate content, you're more like a newspaper than a newsstand, and you therefore are liable for everything that people post. You're just as liable as the person who posted the content.
After that decision hit, which, you know, was shocking to everyone, including me, that I could put a case like this together, suddenly I became an expert on libel. I started getting calls from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Good Morning America. The journalists were intrigued that here's a case setting the rules for online defamation and libel. And within a matter of days, the Prodigy story of this case was in every newspaper in the world. My grandmother in Jerusalem called me and said it was in the Jerusalem Post. So I found out that I had struck a nerve with online services. All of the online services were freaking out.
It's a pretty crazy opinion, because what that's saying is the moment that a platform takes any steps at all to edit content, as he would say, or moderate content, it becomes liable for everything. So under that rationale, you would see platforms as having a very strong incentive to just sort of step back and let people post whatever garbage they want. And whether it's on a service for kids or adults, because the platform can't take on all that liability.
Crazy or not, in 1995, the Prodigy ruling looks like it might become the law of the land, and everyone on the internet is panicking. Can this growing industry stay afloat?
Stratton Oakmont came down the first year I was a law professor.
Benjamin Zapersky teaches at Fordham School of Law. He's been studying online defamation for decades now.
What happened is Prodigy freaked out, and not only did Prodigy freak out, AOL freaked out, everybody freaked out in the internet industry. They ran off to DC and they said, look, if you want us to try to make the internet safe for your kids, then I'll tell you one thing you can't do. You can't give us this twin set of rules that says, if you do nothing, you face no liability. But if you try your best to filter things, then you're liable for everything. You can't do that, because that's a catastrophe.
Meanwhile, Chris Cox and Ron Wyden, our congressional lunch buddies, they were also following the Prodigy ruling. Senator Wyden.
Well, we had these court decisions that had issued contradictory decisions on who'd be liable for things that were posted. Chris and I were kind of people who cared about policy, and we were looking at all these court decisions that made no sense at all. And I said to Chris, I don't know everything about it, but I suspect this new internet deal was going to have zillions of posters. So how in the world would anybody be able to track all this stuff down?
In fact, what Prodigy was doing was attempting to impose rules of the road.
That's former Representative Chris Cox.
They had, you know, standards of online conduct, but they couldn't possibly actually read and edit all of what was going on online, because even in those days, there were millions of posters. Today, there are billions. But the law was not designed for, you know, a newspaper that got millions of pieces of content in a very short period of time and that published it in real time. Looking at this case, what struck me immediately is that here's a new powerful legal incentive, because the lawsuit was for millions of dollars. I'm going to be liable as Prodigy if I moderate their content. So I cannot moderate their content. We cannot have these family-friendly rules. If anything goes, then I'm scot-free of liability. And what would the internet be like if that were the only model that were legal, effectively, in order to avoid this vast liability from a single poster?
Why don't we go with something? And it was something I was very proud of, because it reflected kind of my sort of looking at this with a voter's eye, is we hear our voters always talking about personal responsibility. Let's apply that to content. Let's say that the person who generates the content and posts it, they would be held liable, not the person who's running the website or the platform.
You know, the essential idea was that if someone posts on a site, that person bears the responsibility for what that person says. What tort law attempts to do in general is to place liability on the person who is in the best position to prevent the harm. It would be unreasonable for the law, I believe then and still do, to expect that in the context of real-time communication involving millions or billions of pieces of content, what would be reasonable would be to hold the person who is posting fully responsible for what they do, and, you know, provide some protection for good faith content moderation on the site, because that in societal terms would be ideal. You know, we don't want to have an anything goes model.
That framing, to put responsibility on the poster, that would become the famous 26 words of Section 230. The congressman also built in a shield that would allow platforms to keep fighting unwanted content, including spam posts, without facing a barrage of lawsuits.
The second section of it says, just because somebody is filtering, it doesn't mean you can hold them liable. And it's literally called a Good Samaritan statute.
Ben Zapersky again, the law professor.
What it means is that if, you know, a doctor and lawyer are driving along and drive by a terrible crash in the wilderness, the doctor has the good instinct of wanting to stop to help. And the lawyer says, wait a minute, if you stop and help, we could face liability. Let's keep driving. The doctor might think, oh, I didn't realize that, and keep driving. Totally the wrong set of incentives for society. So what every state has done is put in something called a Good Samaritan statute, and they've existed for over a half a century. And what they say is, if a medical person volunteers to do a rescue, they can't be held liable, because you're a Good Samaritan and we want to incentivize that. So lawyers came along and said, okay, the right thing to do is let's borrow from this other area of the law and build a Good Samaritan statute. So it's all about not creating liability for failing to take things down.
This was so new, Mike, that we wanted to stick to fairly simple concepts, and we wanted to say, all right, you know, if people are going to moderate and take steps to do the right thing, we wanted to encourage that, and it was really pretty simple.
So with those parameters, you know, the law began to take shape.
So there you have it. After the 1-2 punch of Cubby v. CompuServe and Stratton Oakmont v. Prodigy left the young internet wobbling on its feet, two representatives came up with an idea that could become a solid foundation.
Instead of wanting to protect an infant industry, our purpose was to recognize the sheer implausibility of requiring each website to monitor all the user-created content that passed over its portal each day. In the 1990s, internet traffic was measured in the tens of millions. That was already an apparent problem, but today in the third decade of the 21st century, we've got billions. And so we need Section 230 now more than ever. It was not designed for an infant industry. It was designed for something that was so much bigger than the legacy kinds of printing and publishing that had existed before, that needed a different rule.
I wanted to be in this for the small user, and I still am. Because if some of these people who want to unravel 230 and say how horrible it is and Western civilization is going to end, you know, if they're, you know, successful, you're going to have fewer grassroots kind of efforts, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, all these people who probably couldn't have gotten on a platform without 230 existing.
Today, we're closer than we've ever been to living in a world without Section 230. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Before Section 230 could have all these massive effects, it had to make it through Congress. And to do that, Chris Cox and Ron Wyden had to deal with a bigger piece of legislation that was one massive headache.
Congress is debating and drafting this bill, which effectively would create criminal liability for the transmission of indecent content on the internet.
The entire internet would have been dumbed down to the level of what underage people should be allowed to see. It was really quite shocking.
Next episode, Chris and Ron take the hill, and the nation faces a future where the FCC controls the internet.